Hello, this is Jane, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 2nd issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And I'm going to start with an article off the front page under the byline of energy, and the headline here is Alberta Premier Pitches Pipeline to BC. Smith seeks federal approval to fast-track proposal, but project faces major obstacles. And this is by Alex Ballingall. Ottawa, the Alberta government is creating a new proposal to build a major pipeline to the northwest coast of British Columbia, reviving ambitions to export oil through the region and upping the ante in Prime Minister Mark Carney's grand bargain to trade reductions in greenhouse gas emissions from the oil sands for the approval of new fossil fuel infrastructure. Alberta Premier Danielle Smith unveiled the plan on Wednesday, announcing her government will put up $14 million to lead a new pipeline pitch with support from fossil fuel industry advisors and Indigenous business groups, and draft an application to fast-track the project under Ottawa's special nation-building projects law by May 2026. The idea is for a pipeline that would carry 1 million barrels of oil per day from Edmonton to either Prince Rupert or Kitimat, British Columbia, with Alberta handing over construction of the project to an as-yet uncertain private sector proponent if it is approved. But obstacles remain for any such project, including the British Columbia government's vocal skepticism about the nascent proposal, questions about the route it would take, and the existence of a federal ban on significant oil tanker traffic along the north coast of the province. Appearing in Calgary, Smith blamed federal climate regulations for forcing her government to carry the pipeline proposal forward, claiming coastal provinces owe it to landlocked ones to help export their resources. Smith also urged Ottawa to repeal or change the tanker ban and other laws created when Justin Trudeau was Prime Minister, and which the fossil fuel sector has long opposed. This is a test whether Canada works as a country, Smith said. She expressed hope for a signal from Carney that the pipeline could be added to the list of nation-building projects when more proposals are added, as promised, by mid-November. In a statement emailed to the Star, Federal Natural Resources Minister Tim Hodgson made clear Ottawa is open to the idea, but only on certain conditions. The federal government is having an active and constructive dialogue with Alberta, he said, adding that any new pipeline can only proceed if the Pathways Alliance Carbon Capture Project is built to reduce emissions from the oil and gas sector, Canada's top sectoral source of greenhouse gas pollution, according to the federal data. Hodgson also stressed major projects listed under the federal law designed to approve them within 2 years must have meaningful consultations with Indigenous nations, which Alberta officials said is already starting this week, as well as with other affected jurisdictions and align with climate objectives. Once any proponent has done this work, the federal government is open to evaluating a project on its merits. Earlier Wednesday, British Columbia Premier David Eby was pouring cold water on the proposal. He called the federal tanker ban foundational to British Columbians and Indigenous nations who value our coast, and stressed there is no company in the private sector pitching construction of a new oil pipeline through the province. This proposal from the Alberta Premier for taxpayers to do this work comes at the expense of real private sector projects that are going to lift our economy, said Abby, whose NDP government has supported new natural gas export facilities from the BC North Coast. Let's focus on those shovel-ready projects with real proponents that don't have to be funded by taxpayers, he said. Carney recently outlined a grand bargain that would see Ottawa approve a new oil pipeline if the $16.5 billion Pathways project to reduce emissions from the oil sands gets built. Regulations like the oil tanker ban could be changed in such an arrangement, Carney said. While the Star reported in June that the federal government was also open to dropping a planned emissions cap for the oil and gas sector if the Pathways project goes forward. Carney and his environment minister, Julie DeBrusson, have since avoided questions about whether the Liberal government remains committed to Canada's 2030 and 2035 emissions targets under the International Paris Agreement. Smith told reporters she supports Carney's description of the grand bargain, but argued the fossil fuel industry needs significant regulatory changes so that a new pipeline, as well as the carbon capture project, can get built. Both means both, she said. When the climate policy group Clean Prosperity applauded the plan as a possible piece of such a grand bargain, organizations like Environmental Defense decried it as a farce from a province desperate to keep the idea of a new oil pipeline alive. In Ottawa, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre backed the Alberta plan, accusing the Liberal government of having scared away the private sector from building pipelines with climate laws and regulations. Conservatives have long lamented the lack of an oil pipeline through northern British Columbia. For years, they have blamed the Liberal government that took office in Ottawa under Trudeau in 2015 for blocking Enbridge's Northern Gateway proposal. That project was first approved when Stephen Harper's Conservatives were in power, but a federal court struck down that approval in 2016, citing inadequate consultations with Indigenous nations. The Liberal government under Trudeau then announced it would not approve the project at the same time as it greenlighted the controversial expansion of the Trans Mountain oil pipeline from near Edmonton to Burnaby, British Columbia. The pipeline sparked heated opposition from environmentalists and some Indigenous nations. Similarly, objections from Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs over a natural gas pipeline through the province provoked a national movement for Indigenous rights that saw weeks-long rail blockades in 2020. And the next article from the front page is under the byline of Queen's Park. Tories blasted over skill training program. Ministry not fair or transparent in awarding millions to firms, auditor says, finds. This is by Robert Benzie. Premier Doug Ford's government doled out $126 million in training cash to 64 firms that used lobbyists to push poorly rated applications, which is not fair, transparent, or accountable, the Auditor General found. In a critical audit, Shelley Spence said Ford's Ministry of Labor awarded money to the low and medium ranked applications from the Progressive Conservatives controversial $2.5 billion Skills Development Fund, that's SDF. The recipients retained registered lobbyists to lobby the ministry and or minister on behalf of the applicants before they were selected and funded. Spence wrote in a 42-page special report, one of four she tabled Wednesday at Queen's Park. As well, 39 high-ranked applications that were selected by the minister's office and received approximately $58 million in funding had also hired lobbyists, noted the independent watchdog, who did not name any firms or individuals involved. Given that the minister's office selects the applicants for funding and does not select only the applicants that have the highest overall score, this can create an appearance of real or potential preferential treatment by the minister's office in its selection of applicants to fund, she said. It is also not fair, transparent, or accountable to those applying for funding or to the public. Under fire, Labor Minister David Piccinni defended the program, which Ford called one of the greatest that we've ever created, because it has helped 700,000 Ontarians. People with disabilities that typically sit at home and collect the government check are now able to go out there and work and find a skilled trade in different types of jobs, the premier said Wednesday. Piccinni, who admitted selecting lower-scoring applicants he felt were worthy, insisted no one received preferential treatment because they had a lobbyist and denied anything untoward had happened. I stand behind the Skills Development Fund. It's already changed lives, the minister said. But NDP leader Merritt Stiles said this looks like corruption because the Tories used this multi-billion dollar fund to exchange favors with insiders and hand out cash to the same folks that we see popping up over and over and over again. Stiles is now planning to file a formal complaint with the Integrity Commissioner on the matter. Liberal House Leader John Fraser said, "It's not fair to Ontario's 700,000 unemployed people that such favoritism is shown in funding skills training." "It's a racket. It smells like the Greenbelt," said Fraser, referring to Ford's $8.28 billion land swap scandal now being investigated by the RCMP. Green leader Mike Schreiner contended, wealthy, well-connected insiders are making off like bandits from the slush fund. Indeed, Spence concluded, the ministry has not performed an evaluation using all completed SDF project results to determine how the criterion weightings for selecting applications can be updated to better identify and select applications that will achieve their targeted outcomes. At the same time, the minister's office provided no written feedback to ministry staff for the reasoning behind any of the 388 selected and funded applications in rounds 1 and 2 of the SDF. This included 90 applications ranked medium that received about $106 million in funding, and 103 applications ranked low that received about $146 million in funding. These 388 applications received total funding of $479 million. Providing the rationale adds to the fairness, transparency, and accountability in decision-making by the minister's office, said Spence. Providing no documentation can create an appearance of real or potential preferential treatment by the minister's office in its selection of applicants to fund, she said, expressing concern about the lack of a complete and accurate understanding of why applications are selected. In one instance, an organization that had been active for only 3 years with no governing board and had no experience managing public monies and the accompanying data collection, and which presented an inflated budget with no quotes provided for capital expenditures, was chosen by the Labor Minister to receive $4 million for 1 year after requesting $6 million. The application was ranked low with a score of 47%. The minister's office selected the application. The project subsequently had compliance issues with its TPA, that's Transfer Payment Agreement, requirements, including missed targets, failing to meet on-site monitoring requirements, incomplete participant activity reports, and late or missing project activity submissions. Spence's audit comes as the Ontario Public Service Employees Union, that's the OPSEU, has accused the Premier of diverting training money from struggling community colleges to private companies. It's a system that operates in the dark. Taxpayers who fund these programs have almost no reliable information about how that money is spent, what projects are funded to do, or what the results of those programs are. It warned in a 13-page report released in September. OPSEU's intervention exposed tensions within the labor movement. Liuna Construction Locals, arms of the influential private sector union that Ford enlisted to help with skills training, withdrew from the Ontario Federation of Labor over the issue. Joseph Mancinelli, Liuna International Vice President, accused OPSEU of and the OFL of trying to create a conflict between private sector training centers and colleges. This is nothing but bad politics, attacking the Ford government, Mancinelli said last month. However, Liuna Local 3000, which represents 10,000 health, industrial, and professional workers across Canada, remains affiliated with the OFL. And I need to pause here to remind you that you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And I have one more article from the front page, and it is titled TDSB Cancels Consultations on Lottery for Specialty Programs. Board Promises Update on Controversial Admissions Process. And this is by Isabel Teo Tanio. Toronto's Public School Board has abruptly canceled consultations on its controversial lottery-based admissions policy for specialty programs and schools, saying only that an update is coming. In the spring, the Toronto District School Board announced plans to review the policy and launched a public survey that was to remain open until late November. But in recent weeks, the board quietly updated its website to say consultations will not continue as scheduled. We anticipate providing an update in the weeks ahead. On Wednesday, the survey link was disabled. It remains unclear what the update will entail. The board would not comment on specifics, but critics of the current system hope it signals the end of the lottery system and a return to merit-based assessments. Canceling the consultation process has drawn both praise and criticism, with some calling it a sham, while others stress the need for transparency and community input on admissions to coveted high school programs in arts, athletics, science, and math. I don't think you can call it public education if we don't get a say. It's in the name, said Mother Logan Wilson, who was livid about the cancellation. Getting rid of parent consultation is just the next step to doing things and making decisions behind closed doors about money and programming without having to be transparent. A spokesperson for the board said that since the provincially appointed supervisor, Rohit Gupta, joined the TDSB, he has received a variety of feedback from families and school communities about these programs. Over recent months, Mr. Gupta has been reviewing how students are admitted to these programs and will share an update once a decision is made for the 2026-2027 school year. Historically, admission to these coveted specialized programs was a local decision largely based on merit, with students needing to audition, write entry exams, and submit portfolios and personal essays. But in May 2022, trustees overhauled the process, introducing the Student Interest Programs Policy, a centralized system open to any student who expressed interest. The move was aimed at improving equity and increasing the number of kids from underrepresented groups in these programs. When applications exceed available space, often the case, random selection is used with priority given to students from underserved communities. The change sparked both outrage and applause from students, parents, and staff. Some have argued that an interest-based lottery discourages excellence, lowers standards, waters down programs, and has led some students to drop out because they can't keep up or lack passion. But others have countered that it helps break down systemic barriers and open access to more students. In the spring, senior staff at the board said they plan to consult with the public between June and November as they worked on revising the policy. But in late June, the province took over the board, citing financial mismanagement, and appointed a supervisor, stripping trustees of their decision-making powers. Mother Safra Hanif, a co-chair of the parent council at her children's elementary school, said she was disappointed the consultation process was canceled, noting access to specialty programs is a key concern for parents. "It's like you're taking away parents' voices," she said, adding many already feel underrepresented with trustees out of the picture. She opposes requiring students to demonstrate merit through auditions or exams, saying interest alone should be sufficient. At the same time, she rejects a lottery system, arguing the board should expand programs so there are enough seats for every child who wants one. Trustee Wai Dong Pei, who opposes the lottery and supports a return to merit-based admissions, called the cancellation wonderful, dismissing the process as a sham. He noted the survey failed to ask specific questions, offering only one that solicited feedback on the Student Interest Program Policy known as P100. "Most parents don't even know what P100 is," said Pai. "If you want people's opinion, you need to specifically mention the lottery. Otherwise, how would people know?" Pai said the lottery was part of a woke agenda at the TDSB, calling it a failed experiment. He said students have struggled in these programs, teachers have lowered standards, and the board ignored complaints from parents, some of whom delegated at past meetings. "All those community voices were ignored by the board based on their political agenda and woke ideology," he said. But Trustee Michelle Arts, who supports random selection, worries that taking down the survey suggests the process isn't being transparent. She said parents raised concerns and stressed the importance of maintaining a selection process that ensures equitable access. I have a big problem as a parent with decisions being made behind closed doors, said Arts. Regardless of anyone's views on the programs themselves, there was an approved consultation plan that was publicly discussed and debated, and parents were expecting to be able to give feedback. There could be a myriad of reasons to kibosh or change a consultation, but nothing has been posted or communicated to families. Student trustee Victor Zhang is strongly opposed to the lottery, saying many students share his view. A grade 12 student in the TOPS program at Marc Garneau Collegiate Institute, which focuses on math, science, and language arts, Zhang is part of the last merit-based cohort. He says younger students admitted by lottery are less prepared, creating a mismatched classroom in terms of student level, which results in a watered-down curriculum and makes the program less meaningful. Although Zhang has been looking forward to the consultation process, he said the solution is clear: return to merit-based admissions. And the next article is titled, Bradford Confirms Run for Mayor's Job. Councilor Suggests City Isn't Living Up to Its Full Potential, by Ben Spur. Brad Bradford has finally made it official. The Beaches East York councilor has announced he intends to run for mayor next fall. In October of 2026, my name will be on the ballot to be the next mayor of the City of Toronto. I'm really excited about it, he said in an episode of the Brandon Gonez Show that was posted on YouTube Wednesday afternoon. Bradford said he wants to improve basic services like recreation programming and parks, which he asserted have been allowed to deteriorate. I don't think the city's moving in the right direction. I don't think we're living up to our potential. And I think there's a real desire for Toronto to be better, he said. Bradford, a city planner by training, was first elected councillor in 2018. He ran for mayor in the 2023 by-election and placed eighth behind Olivia Chow with less than 2% of the vote. He has since been a high-profile critic of Mayor Chow, setting himself up as the unofficial leader of council's opposition and regularly attacking her in the media over her decisions to raise property taxes and what he described as her failure to improve core services like snow clearing. 2 weeks ago, he launched his own podcast. Although until Wednesday, he claimed he hadn't made a decision, City Hall observers have long assumed he would run again in the October 26, 2026 election. As the Star previously reported, he has been holding campaign-style announcements since early summer and making his pitch to liberal and conservative insiders for why he would be the best center-right candidate to take on Chow, a veteran progressive. Those efforts were an apparent attempt to stake his claim before other like-minded candidates, including former Mayor John Tory, could officially throw their hat into the ring. Tory, who resigned in 2023, after the Star revealed he had a relationship with a woman who worked in his office, is considering making a comeback and has not announced his intentions. Chow has not confirmed she plans to run for re-election, although those close to her say it is likely. Recent polling suggests Bradford could fare well against Chow in a head-to-head race, but his path to victory would be much more difficult in a crowded field of challengers. In response to Bradford's announcement, a spokesperson for Chow didn't confirm she will run next fall, but said the mayor is focused on fixing what people care about most, such as building more rental housing, investing in transit, and tackling crime. Nominations for the municipal election aren't scheduled to open until May 1st. And I need to stop once more and remind you that you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And the next article is under the byline of courts, and it is titled Victim Provoked Fatal Shooting, Judge Rules. Teen found guilty of manslaughter instead of original murder charge for September 2022 killing. This is by Jacques Galland. a teenage boy who chased after another at a Scarborough apartment building and shot him 4 times in the side and back until the gun's magazine was empty, has been acquitted of murder and instead found guilty of manslaughter after the judge concluded he was provoked by the victim. The accused boy, who was 16 at the time of the shooting, cannot be identified under the provisions of the Youth Criminal Justice Act. The law also shields the identity of his 17-year-old victim, as it prohibits identifying young persons who are victims of other young persons, even when they're not related. The accused and several of his schoolmates had been smoking marijuana and listening to music on the afternoon of September 21, 2022, in the stairwell of an apartment building on Gilder Drive near Midland Avenue and Eglinton Avenue East. None of the students lived there. They were approached by the victim, who lives in the building, and 2 friends. A confrontation ensued. Following a judge alone first-degree murder trial, Superior Court Justice Catherine Corrick concluded Wednesday that the victim was the aggressor in that confrontation as he stabbed the accused and threatened to smoke him if he ever saw him again, which the accused understood to mean he would be killed. The accused and some of his friends retreated to the apartment building's parking lot. Corrick found that they were again aggressively approached by the victim, who pointed his arm at the accused and threatened him by saying, What did I say was going to happen if I see you again? The accused then opened fire on the victim with a friend's gun, chasing after the victim and shooting him 2 times in his side and 2 times in his back as he fled. Crown attorneys Leslie Zemoch and Rihanna Woodward argued that the accused had made a plan to shoot and kill the victim because he had been humiliated in front of his friends during the confrontation in the stairwell, and he was therefore guilty of first-degree murder. They argued the accused armed himself with his friend's gun while someone in his group texted someone in the victim's group with their location in a bid to lure him. Defense lawyers Monty McGregor and Simona Petty argued that their client was frightened as a result of the victim's earlier threat in the stairwell, and that he asked his friend for his gun to stop the victim from approaching in the parking lot. The accused testified he was scared the victim was about to rush him and stab him again. The accused said he freaked out and started shooting. After firing his first shot, which missed the victim, he chased after him and continued shooting until the gun's magazine was empty. He testified he felt out of control. In excerpts of her decision, read in court Wednesday with lengthy written reasons to be delivered later, Corrick rejected that the accused was acting in self-defense, which would have meant a full acquittal. She found the accused did not fire at the victim to defend himself from the threat of force, nor was the shooting reasonable in the circumstances. I find that the only reasonable inference that can be drawn from the evidence that shows the accused chasing the victim and firing a gun that he knew was loaded at the victim's back at close range is that he intended to kill the victim, Corrick said. I am satisfied, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the accused had the required intent for murder. But Corrick went on to find that the Crown had failed to disprove that the accused had been provoked by the victim. He was therefore entitled to be found guilty of the lesser offense of manslaughter. Corrick did not elaborate. The Crown said it intends to seek an adult sentence for the accused, who is now 19. Okay, the next article is under the byline of Queen's Park, a $10 a day child care program at risk. Auditor General report says province facing almost $2 billion funding shortfall and must fix staffing. This article is by Kristen Rochowy. the province is facing an almost $2 billion shortfall in funding for the National Child Care Program next year. It needs to reach an agreement with federal government soon so families can plan ahead, says the Auditor General. While Education Minister Paul Calandra said he too wants to provide parents with certainty, the province is unlikely to meet the program's low-fee target without more money from Ottawa. I don't think, frankly, that we will be in a position to meet the $10 a day program as set up by the federal government unless they are willing to step up to the plate and add the money that is required to get us to $10 a day, he told reporters at Queen's Park. In its report, the Office of the Auditor General of Ontario also said the province needs to address both staffing and space shortages under the Canada-wide Early Learning and Child Care Agreement that receives the majority of its funding from Ottawa. While Ontario has yet to reach the average lower daily rate, it has already seen a 50% decrease in costs to parents to an average of about $19 a day. Parents and guardians of children enrolled with child care licenses participating in the child care program have received the benefit of reduced fees, the report said. However, it adds the long-term sustainability of the program is uncertain. Families need to know what will happen in April 2026, which is only 6 months away, and the years beyond so they can plan for their child care costs. In a written response to the auditor, the Education Ministry said it would meet the $10 a day average and will take corrective action as needed to ensure that target is realized. But Calandra stressed to reporters that it's up to the feds to make that happen. Without an updated agreement between the two levels of government, the auditor said there is a chance fees could return to more than $30 a day. They averaged $39 prior to the program and $89 a day in Toronto, while noting that the province and feds have agreed in principle to a 5-year extension. The clock is ticking, warned Carolyn Ferns of the Ontario Coalition for Better Child Care. Among other recommendations, the auditor suggested Ontario look at the costs of other provinces that have achieved the $10 a day ahead of schedule, address the need for 10,000 early childhood educators as well as 80,500 unfilled spots in child care centers. While staffing shortages are partly to blame, Calandra said there are unused spaces because Ottawa wants them to be nonprofit. But in Ontario, the system was based and built on both not-for-profit and for-profit. And when one entire section of childcare is forbidden from participating in the system, then you're seeing some of the challenges that we are facing right now. But NDP leader Merritt Stiles blamed the province for a failed rollout of the program and urged that it step up and do the right thing here and boost its own funding contribution. Liberal MPP John Fraser said the report chronicles the province's mismanagement of the program, adding, "It's not fair if you've been looking for childcare for 4 years and haven't been able to find a space." The auditor estimates that based on current funding levels, the province would spend $130 million in 2026 through 27, compared to federal funding of $2.91 billion, and that still leaves the program $1.95 billion short. Across the country, half of provinces offer $10 a day care. A recent study by the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives found. And next, we have a headline of 5 people arrested at second clearing of Dufferin Grove Camp. Neighborhood area residents among those charged at park. And this is by Manuela Vega. Days after the City of Toronto brought in heavy machinery to clear a long-standing homeless encampment at Dufferin Grove Park, city staff and private security guards returned on Wednesday morning to remove people who had promptly returned. Encampment residents and observers told the Star that city staff and security began dismantling the encampment at about 7:15 a.m., pulling some people out of their tents and advising them they had a few minutes to collect their belongings. Police arrested five people at the park, including two encampment residents and three community members. Toronto police did not immediately respond to the Star's questions about the charges the five people faced. Other park attendees were told they would be arrested if they returned, one observer said. A city spokesperson told the Star that enforcement is a last resort, but people who continue to violate their existing trespass notices were informed they may be placed under arrest if they remained in the park. By about 10:30 a.m., security guards had detained one person who told the Star she had been sticking up for the people in tents that morning. Jazzy Kaiser, a neighborhood resident who said she did not live in the park, said guards chased, tackled, and handcuffed her, and police later gave her a trespass order forbidding her from entering the park. I was just there to put myself in front of the more vulnerable residents who are facing this exact kind of harm every day under threat by the security, she said. The City of Toronto spokesperson said the city disagrees with the account and noted trespass violations in the public parks are carried out under the Ontario Trespass to Property Act. Gord Tanner, general manager of Toronto Shelter and Support Services, told the Star in a statement that trespass notices were issued for new tents on Saturday. He said that over 237 days, the city had provided dedicated, enhanced homelessness services, referred more than 70 people to shelter, and helped 9 more secure housing. Every effort has been made to care for the people encamped in the park, help ensure the park is available to the broader community, and to avoid enforcement, Tanner said. The city remains committed to addressing the homelessness crisis and ensuring communities can access their parks. By 11 a.m., only metal fencing that had been erected after Friday's clearing around the center of the park remained, with four security guards standing on the perimeter. One encampment resident, who identified themselves as Wren and said they were Indigenous, said they had been staying at the encampment since March 2024 and had tried staying at two shelters during that time. They had returned to the park because it was the only place they said they felt safe. "I'm fed up," they said. Next article is titled, "Ottawa Rejects Plan to Ship Marineland Whales to China." Marineland said it is profoundly disappointed by the federal government's decision to deny its request to ship 30 belugas to China, and the park has no ability to pay for their care, with sources adding that means euthanasia is a real possibility. Fisheries Minister Joanne Thompson announced Wednesday the federal government would not grant an export permit to ship Canada's last captive whales to the Chimelong Ocean Kingdom Aquarium. Thompson said she will not subject the belugas to a future performing in captivity, which is consistent with a federal law passed in 2019. 20 whales, one killer whale, and 19 belugas have died at Marineland since 2019, according to a database created by the Canadian Press based on internal documents and official statements. The remaining whales are now in limbo as Marineland looks to sell its Niagara Falls theme park and the vast swath of land it owns near Horseshoe Falls. There are no other options, Marineland said, following several years of work to find a permanent home for our belugas, the humane relocation to an accredited facility abroad was the only viable option to ensure our beloved whales remained alive and received the care they deserve, the company said in an email. The park noted that there is no sanctuary in the world that can take the whales, despite what animal activists say. Today's decision by the Kearney government condemns these magnificent animals to an uncertain future at a closed facility with no ability to pay for their continued feeding and care, it said. And I need to pause one more time to remind you, you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And here's another article on the under the byline of courts. Babysitter's lawyer accuses mother of causing son's death. Defense alleges toddler hurt head under parental care and injury was kept secret. And this is by Kevin Donovan. In a fiery courtroom exchange, the lawyer for a babysitter charged in the death of a London, Ontario area toddler accused the boy's mother of causing and hiding her son's fatal injury. You wonder how this could have been different if you had just told Megan Van Hoof as you were handing your son off, if you had just told her he had a hit on the head last night. Keep an eye on him. Defense lawyer Jeff Snow asked Roseanne Van De Wiel, Nathaniel McClellan's mother. I have not wondered that because it is not true, Van De Wiel replied. In his seventh and final day of cross-examination of Van De Wiel, Snow put to her that she has done everything she could over the past 10 years to have his client blamed for the death of 15-month-old Nathaniel McClellan in October 2015, including keeping information secret. Snow suggested Van De Wiel knew she had injured her son with an accidental door bump the night before he was taken to Van Hoof's daycare and that Van De Wiel should have told the babysitter he was unwell. Van De Wiel said this was untrue. Her son was fine when she dropped him off in the morning before heading to her job as a grade 4 teacher. She also has testified that 6 doctors, some will testify at the trial, who cared for Nathaniel, told her that given the type of serious head trauma he suffered, he would have been unresponsive almost immediately after the injury. Van Hoof has pleaded not guilty to the charge of manslaughter in the trial before Justice Michael Carnegie in London. There is no jury. Court has heard that Van Hoof called Van De Wiel before noon on Tuesday, October 27, 2015, telling her that Nathaniel had fallen and hit his head, according to Van De Wiel's account. Van De Wiel testified that she picked up Nathaniel and rushed him to the hospital. He died 4 days later on October 31. Ms. Van De Wiel, for you, this court process is not about the truth and finding out what happened. For you, this is a process of taking the blame off you, having the public think this wasn't you, Snow said during a heated point in his cross-examination. No, Van De Wiel replied, this wasn't me. Snow continued, this is a process in taking blame off you and putting it on Megan Van Hoof. Van De Wiel replied, for me, this whole process, it was not about Megan. I did everything I did because I love my son. That's why I did everything, because I love him, because I want to know what happened to him. Snow has painted a picture of a mother dead set on having his client charged and convicted. He took Van De Wiel through research she had done, including Children's Aid Society protocols, police interview techniques, and coroner's reviews, appearing to suggest that she was trying to inform herself prior to being interviewed by police. On reexamination, Crown Attorney Meredith Gardner asked her if she had done these before or after a series of interviews police conducted with her. Vandeweel said it was after. As court has heard, Nathaniel was stiff and unresponsive when Vandeweel took him from the babysitter. A few minutes later, at the hospital, Vandeweel said Nathaniel flailed as she was struggling to find her health card in the busy emergency room lobby. Snow played a police interview with Vandeweel describing the hospital scene. "I picked him up and his whole body fell backward. I mean wildly fell backwards," Vandeweel testified. "That's where he could have hurt himself." Snow put it to Vandeweel that she was admitting to hurting Nathaniel. Vandeweel said that was impossible because Nathaniel was already unresponsive and appeared not to be breathing when she collected him from Van Hoof on the street. She told court she thought he was dead. In another point of contention in court Wednesday was a series of audio recordings Vandeweel secretly made of meetings she had with doctors who treated her son. The recordings were made a year or more after Nathaniel died. Vandeweel had said she was trying to learn as much as she could about what happened to Nathaniel and wanted a record of what the doctors said. Vandeweel has not released those recordings to police, the Crown, or defense. "You didn't want to share these recordings because you know the things you talked about with the doctors undermine your view of how things happened to Nathaniel," Snow said. "That is not correct," Vandeweel replied. She told court that she initially didn't hand these over because she had lost faith in police. Asked Thursday if she would release them, Vandeweel said no. "Because I've seen how my words were twisted in this experience, and I'm not going to. The doctors are coming to testify, and there's nothing that they said to me that they wouldn't say in court. They're professional," Vandeweel said. The judge warned Vandeweel that she needed to preserve the integrity of the recordings in case she is required to hand them over. And there's another article right under that one, under the byline of military. U.S. approves sale of rocket systems to Canada. The U.S. State Department has approved the possible sale of M142 high mobility artillery rocket systems and related equipment to Canada. A news release from the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, part of the U.S. Department of Defense, estimates the cost of the sale at $1.75 billion, that's U.S. dollars, and says the principal contractor is Lockheed Martin. The release says Canada has asked to buy 26 of the systems called HIMARS, or H-I-M-A-R-S, HIMARS for short, along with other items. The release says the proposed sale will support the foreign policy and national security objectives of the United States by helping to improve Canada's military capabilities. This capability will protect Canada by improving Canada's contribution to collective hemispheric defense and to defense and deterrence in Europe, as directed by NATO's defense plans, the release says. Canada will have no difficulty absorbing these articles and services into its armed forces. The HIMARS sale has been approved by the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, but it will still require congressional approval. And I have time for one more short article, and this is World News in the Philippines, rescuers in desperate search after earthquake. Bogo, Philippines. Rescuers use backhoes and sniffer dogs to look for survivors in collapsed houses and other damaged buildings in the central Philippines on Wednesday, a day after an earthquake killed at least 69 people and injured more than 200 others. The death toll was expected to rise from the 6.9 magnitude quake that hit at about 10 p.m. on Tuesday and trapped an unspecified number of residents in the hard-hit city of Bogo and outlying rural towns in Cebu province. Sporadic rain and damaged bridges and roads have hampered the race to save lives, officials said. On Wednesday night, rescuers in orange and yellow hard hats used spotlights, a backhoe, and bare hands to sift through the rubble of concrete slabs, broken wood, and twisted iron bars for hours in a collapsed building in Bogo City. No survivors were found. We're still in the golden hour of our search and rescue. Office of Civil Defense Deputy Administrator Bernardo Rafaelito Alejandro IV said in a morning news briefing in Manila, there are still many reports of people who were pinned or hit by debris. The epicenter of the earthquake, which was set off by movement in an undersea fault line at a dangerously shallow depth of 5 kilometers, was about 19 kilometers northeast of Bogo, a coastal city of about 90,000 people in Cebu province, where about half of the deaths were reported, officials said. And I'm out of time, so I'm going to have to end with, you've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 2nd issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Jane. Thank you for listening.